Hello, I'm your host, Erin Gruel, and welcome to the Freedom Writers Podcast. Today's show is episode number 48, featuring my conversation with educator and anti-racism advocate, Jane Elliott, whose seminal Blue Eye, Brown Eyed exercise on prejudice was the subject of the ABC documentary, The Eye of the Storm. Jane discusses how the death of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. inspired her to educate her students about the effects of racism and how she's made it her life's mission to encourage others to see only one race, the human race. After my interview with Jane, you'll hear from original freedom writer Tanya Payne, whose experiences, as documented in diary number 54 in the Freedom Writer's Diary, are a poignant example of the prejudice that Jane taught her students to avoid. Tanya explores what it felt like to be an African-American student in the Distinguished Scholars Program at Woodrow Wilson High School, and how she was expected to quote-unquote get the black perspective as the sole representative from the African-American community in her gifted program. Both Jane and Tanya's personal stories are harrowing and a thought-provoking expose into the disturbing legacy of racism in education. And I hope these conversations will leave you feeling enlightened and empowered to make a difference. Today's guest, Jane Elliott, is not only a world-renowned educator, but a fervent fighter for change. On April 4, 1968, Jane's life was forever changed when Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was shot and killed in Memphis, Tennessee. Struck by the horror of his assassination, Jane took it upon herself to educate her third-grade students in Riceville, Iowa, about how it feels to be discriminated against because of a physical characteristic over which they had no control. Jane's now notorious blue-eye, brown-eyed exercise started the very next day. In the years since Jane stepped foot in her third-grade classroom to educate her students about the effects of discrimination, she has gone on to become a leading voice for inclusivity, educating university students, the incarcerated, and employees of Fortune 500 companies. Jane has not only been the subject of countless documentaries, including PBS Frontlines, A Class Divided, but has also appeared on talk shows such as The Oprah Winfrey Show. Without further ado, here is my conversation with the formidable Jane Elliott. I am going to assume the role today for this interview as a student who is rapt. I feel like I'm in a classroom with one of the finest educators I have studied and read and watched, and she's gonna school me, and she's gonna school our audience. And so I am so eager to learn lessons, to be humble, to receive the messages that she provides. And I have my notebook in hand, and I'm taking notes because I wanna make sure that these lessons don't fall on deaf ears. So we're in the lovely home of the educator, activist, advocate, Jane Elliott.
Not activist. I'm not an activist. I am an educator of anybody who believes in the myth of three or four or five different races. There's only one.
Let's start there. Let's start with and that's a wonderful place to start because in our country right now, it's trying times. And racism is at an all-time high. Anti-Semitism is at an all-time high. The rights of the LGBTQ community is being vilified and made to feel other. And I love that you educate and advocate for people who are marginalized. And you often start with a lesson on the human race. So for our audience, can you educate us about the human race?
I lead people out of ignorance. Racism is pure ignorance. Racism is an emotional commitment to ignorance. And we know better, we could do better, but we refuse to admit that we know we're wrong. Because there is no such thing as a white person. There is not a white person living on the face of the earth. We educators start creating cognitive dissonance in kids when they come to kindergarten. We hand them a bunch of crayons and we say, and this one is the white one. And those little so-called white kids put that crayon against their hand and look at it and have to think, which of these is white? And immediately that kid knows that that educator isn't telling him or her the truth. There's something wrong here, and kids know it immediately.
And I know that the etymology of educate,
right,
educate has wonderful meaning for you. So for our audience, can you break down educate?
The word educate comes from the root duck deuce, which means lead, the prefix e, which means out, the suffix ate, which means the act of, and the suffix "-or," which means one who does. An educator is one who is engaged in the act of leading people out of ignorance. We aren't there in that so-called educational institution to teach people things that will make them good United States of America citizens. We are there to educate them so that they will be good citizens of the world.
Well, our audience is citizens of the world. So how would you lead, as a leader, our audience out of ignorance when it comes back to the classification of race, which we started with? I think that you have a wonderful way of leading people to look at race rather than demarcating by colors, but unifying by the singularity of the human race.
You will invariably group people according to color. There are 2,500 different skin colors on the face of the earth. If you can find 2,500 different names for races, you've got too much time on your hands. You should get busy and do something else, because it's a worthless endeavor. Those are not 2,500 different races. Those are 2,500 different skin colors. A person has a right to be recognized as their skin color, but as that skin color, as a member of the human race. In my estimation, God allowed one race to evolve. That race was black. Human beings created racism. We have created something that we could destroy if we chose to. Anything you create, you can destroy. We have created racism, and I know how to destroy racism. You have to teach children the truth. And the way you teach children the truth is by doing what John Dewey said. John Dewey, a great educator, said, "We learn by doing." And so the day after Martin Luther King Jr. was killed,
April 4th
of 1968, and I really hate to talk about that day, because I watched my son die, I watched my father die, I watched my little sister die when she was 3 years old. We all knew about J.F. Kennedy being killed. None of that was as, for me, traumatic as the killing of Martin Luther King Jr. was. He represented hope for me, and hope for me is an acronym for holding on to positive energy. That's what he did. And because he was holding on to positive energy and making change for people of different color groups, we had to kill him. And I say we because this society killed that man. The person who shot him is the one who killed him. The rest of us encouraged that.
Enabled.
We more than enabled it. We encouraged it. We said, kill him. Because that's what we do in this society. If they disagree with us, we destroy them. We have a history of destroying those who would keep us from taking over their land, or who would keep us from having our religion and only our religion.
For our listeners, they didn't see your eyes welled with tears when you talked about April 4th, 1968. And what they don't know is that in February of that same year, you celebrated Martin Luther King with your students as a hero, that you were in the midst of this great lesson looking at Native Americans.
And it wasn't a great lesson. Let's get this perfectly straight here.
I'm assuming everything you did was great.
No. It was better than most of the people around me were doing, but that didn't make it great. I was doing the Native American unit, which we called the Indian unit, because it was springtime. In the springtime, the sap is rising, the birds are singing, the grass is growing, and the kids want to get out of school. So you have to do something that will keep them excited about going to school. They're tired of school by April, and you've already had April Fool's Day, and they're all making you feel like a fool because they're really tired of school. So I do the Indian unit in the spring. I was on my way home. I was taking the teepee that my previous year's third graders had made. I was going to wash it, dry it, iron it on the living room floor, put it up in the classroom the next day. We were going to paint it with Indian symbols chosen by white folks. We were going to sing Native American songs chosen by white folks. We were going to learn the Sioux Indian prayer, which was taught to the Indians by a missionary, which is, "Oh, great spirit, keep me from ever judging a man until I've walked a mile in his moccasins." I was going to teach my kids that the next day, because I think that's an important thing for them to know. I walked into my house, the telephone was ringing, I answered the telephone, my sister said, "Is your television on?" I said, "No, better turn it on." "Why?" "They shot him." I said, "Who'd we shoot this time?" Because we were in a shooting mode at that time.
JFK,
it was
Robert
a joke.
Kennedy.
Yeah, "Who'd we shoot this time?" She said, "Martin Luther King Jr." And for a few seconds, my world stopped turning, because all I could think was, how could we do that? How low will we go? And now I realize that wasn't the lowest we could go, because now we are lower. Now, when you do the work I do, you get letters that are worse than what I got at that time. I put the kids to bed, I washed and dried the teepee, laid it out on the living room floor. watching television, I went ballistic. I rolled that teepee up, I threw it into the closet, I slammed the door on it, and I commenced to get my husband's supper ready because he worked nights at that time. And I decided that the next morning, not only were my kids going to learn the Sioux Indian prayer, I was going to arrange to have it answered for them. So when my husband came home, he said, they shot him, didn't they? I said, yeah. He said, what are you going to do? I told him what I was going to do, and he said, you're going to lose your job. I said, well, if I lose my job, I'd rather not teach if I have to teach and let this happen and not say anything about it. He said, you want to be careful. We have to live in this community. These people aren't going to like this. I said, what did the men say that you rode home with? He said, you don't want to know. And then he came home to this woman who was crying over something the men were cheering about. I went to bed, got up the next morning, got ready for school, started out the door, and he said, you aren't going to do that. I said, yes, I am. He said, well, good luck. I said, thanks a lot. And I went quickly because I didn't want him to see the tears in my eyes. I expected him to support me on this. I expected my parents to support me. No, uh-uh. I had embarrassed the family when this thing happened. I went to school. First kid in the room, Stephen Armstrong, came in and said, hey, Elliot, they shot that king last night. Why'd they shoot that king? I said, we're going to talk about that, Stephen.
For our listeners who are young or in other countries, can you paint a picture of Riceville, Iowa, April 5th, 1968, the day after the assassination, so they could visualize through your illumination the community that you were living and teaching? What did it look like and feel like as far as demographics?
They're all in farm-related industries. Most of them are farmers. The ones who are in business dress down, and the ones who are farmers dress down farther. Because you work in the field or you work with animals all day and you go to town, you run to town and you get something done. They're mostly farmers, and they're smart, and they're money makers, and they're Christians. Absolute Christians. We had one Jewish person there, but they put up with it because he would loan you money. And he ran a grocery store, and you could get credit there, buy things on credit.
So it was a small community, about 1,000 people.
1,000 people. On a good day, it's 1,000 people.
And how would they, teaching?
For what you're doing here, and for that time, they were members of the white race.
Self-selected white race?
No, that is the way you were raised. This is the white race. It wasn't until the 70s that they came out with a flesh-colored Band-Aid, the color of my flesh. Not my black friend's flesh. Crayola came out with a flesh-colored crayon, pink. We also have, I bought a pair of flesh-colored pantyhose. I showed them to one of my black friends while I was working at US West, and she said, yeah, you think they'd look good on me? I said, absolutely not. That's what I'm talking about. She said, I know what you're talking about. We do not recognize black flesh as real flesh.
It's now April 5th. Little Stephen says they shot a king. Why did they shoot a king? And what you did was masterful. It was kinesthetic.
Wait a minute. You have to know that what I did was create a microcosm of society in a third grade classroom. It was an exercise in learning how to walk in another person's shoes. It was an exercise in empathy. I wouldn't have called it that day. I simply wanted them to know how it felt to be treated in an unpleasant way because of a physical characteristic over which you have no control. I had read all about the Nazis, and I was 8 years old when the Second World War started. I knew about the Nazis. I knew about the concentration camps. And I finally said, do you kids have any idea how it would feel to be something other than white in this country? No. Would you like to know? Yeah, yeah. I said, would you like to do something today that would help you know that? Yeah, yeah. It was like we've already gotten out of spelling and handwriting. Keep this broad talk and we don't have to learn anything all day long. I said, okay, today we're going to judge people by the color of their eyes. And because I'm blue-eyed, most of the students in this room are blue-eyed, brown-eyed kids are going to be on the top on the first day in this exercise. And immediately they said, what do you mean? I said, I mean blue-eyed people aren't as smart as brown-eyed people. They aren't as clean as brown-eyed people. They aren't as civilized as brown-eyed people. You give blue-eyed people something nice, and what do? And they said, they reckon. I said, yeah, they reckon. At that point, little brown-eyed Debbie, third grader, sitting in the front row, looked up at me, and she said, how come you're the teacher here if you got them blue eyes? And I thought, why, you little shit. All of a sudden, she turned the tables on me.
In 2 minutes.
2 minutes. She got the power. She knew how to use it. She knows the vocabulary. She knows the behavior. She knows what she is allowed to do. And I didn't teach her any of those things. But this society has taught her every one of those things. Her grandfather fought in the Second World War. But she has heard all of these things. I've known these people all my life. I was shocked at what I found out on that first 20 minutes. Exactly how racist I am. I watched kids become me. I watch brown-eyed kids exhibit all the behaviors that their former teachers, their present teachers, their principal, the superintendent, the clerk in the grocery store, the person who fixes their father's tractor, the man in the meat market, they have watched us and they know how to behave. And I watched my third graders become me. And in that moment, I learned more than any of my students did. I kept thinking, oh my God, where did she learn that? Where did she hear that? What would make him think that? But when Debbie said, how come you're the teacher here if you got them blue eyes? Blue-eyed Alan Moss in the back row said, ah, Debbie, her eyes ain't got nothing to do with it. He said, she'd be the principal or the superintendent here if she didn't have those blue eyes. I watched Debbie become me.
In general, you, Izzy, when you say become me.
I mean me as a pale-faced Christian educator. Obviously, at that time, I didn't believe in the rightness of whiteness, but I was supposed to. What I did that day made a group of students who will not go along with what's happening in this country because they know better. Because I taught them empathy. I taught them to think about how it would feel to be in somebody else's shoes. That first afternoon, it was hell. It was absolute hell. The brown-eyed kids were happy, happier than they had ever been. That first year, I watched children who were brown-eyed and dyslexic read words I knew they couldn't read and spell words I knew they couldn't spell. And I knew that they were behaving in that way and their academic ability was growing as a result of being told they could do it. And I thought, oh my God, is this what we do all day, every day in the schools all over this country to children who are white and comparing them to children who are children of other color groups? It was absolutely astonishing what was happening. So at noon, I went down to the teacher's lounge to tell the other two third grade teachers what was happening in my classroom. I needed some support. Foolishly, I thought I would get some support. I walked in. There were a number of teachers there. I told them what was going on in my classroom. When I finished telling them what was happening, the younger of the other two third grade teachers, who was probably 54 at the time, said, I don't know how you have time for all that extra stuff. It's all I can do to teach reading, writing, arithmetic. Well, she hadn't taught reading, writing, arithmetic yet, as far as I was concerned. She should have done the extra stuff. The other one, over 60 years old, had been molding young minds for over 30 years, said, on the day after Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated, I don't know why you're doing that. I thought it was about time somebody shot that son of a bitch. Nobody frowned. Nobody said, Helen, God is love. Nobody said, in so much as ye have done it unto one of these my brethren, so have ye done it unto me. Every one of them either smiled or laughed and nodded because she had expressed their feelings perfectly, and as the most senior member of the group, she had the most right to do so. I was going to stop at noon. At that minute, I decided that we would finish the day with the brown-eyed people on top and the blue-eyed people on the bottom, and I would send them home, and on Monday, we would reverse the exercise. No person of any age will ever leave my presence with those attitudes unchallenged. You have to prove to me that white people are superior, and you can't do it because it isn't true. We create a society in which we treat people positively or negatively based on the color of their skin. And it isn't based on the color of their skin. It's based on the ignorance of those who see color as a negative. We have to put a stop to this. And we have to stop it now. You can't make racist remarks. You couldn't when those kids were in school, those third graders. Parents would come to me and say, well, you changed the way we live in our house. I said, well, what do I do? Well, my mother-in-law came in yesterday and my daughter said, we don't use that N-word in our house, Grammy. And if you're going to use it, I'm going to go outside until you go home. Now, I didn't teach them much about respect for their elders. I did teach them something about elders who deserve respect. And one who uses the N-word does not deserve respect unless that woman is a black woman who has the right to use that word if she chooses to. But no pale face has the right to use that word.
When you were doing the exercise, did words like inferior and superior, were they used or did the students just automatically feel inferior,
Absolutely.
Feel superior? And talk about some of the actions they did, because the kids who were feeling superior were reading better words and were quicker at their vocabulary. So you saw almost immediately. 24 hours.
No. 24 minutes.
24 minutes.
24 minutes. 20 minutes. Yeah. It was absolutely unbelievable that you could change a child's academic ability by telling him for a few minutes that he or she is brilliant. And that's what I did. At the end of the day, Billy Thompson came up and said, where's my spelling paper? I said, what do you want it for, Billy? He said, I want to take it home and show it to my mother. I said, why? He said, because she thinks I can't spell and I can. He started to cry and I started to cry because here he is, the seventh month of his third grade year, after being in kindergarten, first grade, second grade, and now third grade. And he didn't know until the seventh month of his third grade year that he could spell. because his previous teachers had expected him not to learn. I was just shocked at what I watched happen. In my room that year, I had Carol, the Lutheran minister's daughter. Brilliant. She came in February reading at the sixth grade level. She had never multiplied. I taught her how to multiply in 15 minutes flat the first day she was in my classroom. She did beautifully until the day she had the wrong color eyes, and she was blue-eyed. And on that day, she made mistakes in reading, she mistakes in spelling, she forgot how to multiply. That should never have happened to her. She went out to recess, and little brown-eyed Debbie and two of her friends stepped up behind her. One of them reached up, struck her across the back with her forearm, and when Carol turned around, Debbie said to her, "Now you have to apologize to me, because I'm better than you are." And Carol apologized and came in crying. And I said, "What's going on here?" And they told me. And I couldn't correct her, because after all, she was a brown-eyed person. Carol must have gotten in her way. Don't get her in her way again. Because we do that all the time. But worse than that, we shoot them.
So as you were doing the exercise on day one, there's this inferior and superior relationship happening. When they came back for the second day of the exercise, you reversed it. So talk about what happened on the second day when the kids that were inferior were now superior and vice versa.
I sent those kids home Friday night, didn't clean it up, didn't tell them it was going to be reversed.
So they had a whole weekend ruminate and
they
take those feelings
weekend.
Home.
The boys had planned in the boys' restroom. They planned what they were going to do to those kids when they got the chance. Well, they didn't know they were going to get the chance, but they knew that this wasn't going to stay this way. I was afraid to go home. I was sure there'd be a cross burning in my front yard because we burn crosses in Iowa. I didn't want to go home. I didn't want to think about what was going to happen. Went home. Nothing happened over the weekend. Nobody attacked
and you,
me.
And you have four children as well.
Yeah, my four children were fine. On Monday, I went back into the classroom. I reversed the exercise. I expected those blue-eyed kids to really lay into those brown-eyed kids. The blue-eyed kids were much less vicious to the brown-eyed kids than the brown-eyed kids had been to them.
Because of empathy? Because they had experienced?
They had learned something that no other student in that school had learned. So at the end of the day, we wrote four paragraph compositions telling how the child felt on Monday, how the child felt on Friday, what discrimination is, and who Martin Luther King Jr. was. Then we got in the magic circle and they read their essays. And it was amazing what they had learned by going through that exercise. It was just fantastic. And I said to them, "You want to go through the exercise again?" "No, why not? I don't ever want to make somebody feel the way I felt yesterday." And I asked them, "Why didn't you get even? You said you were going to get even." "I didn't want to make anybody feel like I felt when I was on the bottom." That's a good lesson to learn. That's a valuable lesson to learn. My dad would say, "If you haven't walked in his shoes, don't judge him." I'd heard it all my life. I had never applied it. And I applied it that day. We all learned a tremendous amount. And the amount that we learned has stayed with them. When those kids went my third graders, when they go up to junior high, there was a teacher up there who used the N-word quite often.
Oh. In a classroom? On a schoolyard?
We're talking 1968 to 1975 to 1984. Absolutely. And she used that word. She was an English teacher. And she came down to lunch at the teacher's lounge in the middle of the day and said to the teachers, "I've just had the worst experience." "Then what happened?" "Well," and then she said, "I used that word." And then one of the kids said, "We don't use that word in this school. And if you're going to use that word, I'm going to go out in the hall until you stop. What would you have done?" Unfortunately for her, my sister was substituting that day. And she looked up at her and she said, "Well, I guess I'd stop using that word."
And this was one of your former students.
And one of my fellow students had said to her, "We don't use that word in this school. And if you're going to use it, I'm going to go outside and I'm out in the hall until you go home." But you see, the important part of that is he had grown a little up, not just older, but he had grown up enough that he could challenge a person with a degree, several degrees, and he could challenge her because she was flat out wrong. And he knew he had the right to stop her, and she didn't have the right to keep on using that word. You do not have the right to do that kind of thing in the classroom. However, my first year of college, I was taking a course in elementary education, whatever. The professor said, in front of all these teacher trainees, "When you get in the classroom, you must not teach in opposition to the local mores. The people who are paying your wages through their taxes have the right to have their children learn what they want them to learn." Now, I was 19 years old and I was saying, "Well, that's not right. What's the matter?" Did I stop him and say, "You're wrong about that"? No, no, no. I wanted to get a grade. I kept my mouth shut. I should have stood up and said, "I think you're wrong." I thought he was wrong. Now I know he was wrong. You must teach in opposition to the local mores. No, you must teach in opposition to the local mores if the local mores include racism, sexism, ageism, homophobia, and ethnocentrism. You had better teach in opposition to those, or you are not educating. You're just teaching.
For our listeners, I highly recommend that they watch both The Eye of the Storm and A Class Divided, because in A Class Divided, your students come back.
Right.
And they come back with their spouses.
Right.
And what I loved about this reunion is all these years later, your students and their spouses talk about how they treat their neighbors, their children, and their community. It stuck with them since the time they were in third grade. How did that make you feel that this exercise changed their lives?
You have to know that the exercise didn't change their lives, and I didn't change their lives. They changed their lives. You could go through that and just, you know, let it wash off. Those who really related to it never forget it, and it changes their lives because they decide to make some changes. That kid who said, we don't use that word in this classroom, made a choice. He could have just let it go and go along to get along, but he didn't do that. He decided to open up his mouth and shut hers.
Stand up and speak out.
We have to raise children who absolutely will not go along with what's wrong. My dad would say, once a week, you know the difference between right and wrong. Now do the right thing, goddammit. And he said, don't judge a book by its cover. You don't know anything about that person's life until you've lived his life.
You had four children.
Mm-hmm.
And when you ran the exercise, you spoke about it with your husband. You did not forewarn your children. And I understand that it was not always easy for your children, your husband, and your parents. So can you talk about the ramifications of you teaching and educating people to critically think, to question authority, standing up and speaking out, and then your own family being vilified and victimized?
Yeah. Good deeds will not go long unpunished. Make no mistake about that. You put your head above the parapet and somebody will shoot it off. And that's what happened. Only they didn't shoot me. They abused my children. Teachers, peers, and the parents of my children's peers abused my children in every way they possibly could.
Physical, emotionally.
Physical, emotional, psychological. And my children were exposed to that. They were treated like pariahs. They lost all their friends. They didn't dare walk on certain streets in Riceville. No Elliott kids better walk on our streets. Five high school boys chased my junior high son home from school. He didn't run fast enough one day. I came home and he was black and blue and bloody and beaten. And I said, what in hell happened to you? And then he told me. And I called the parents and one of the parents said, you should have thought of that before you did that thing. He got what you asked for. And that's what one of the teachers said when I went up to junior high and complained about what was happening to Sarah. And that's what she said. And I thought, well, you must not teach in opposition to the local mores. This is what he really meant. He wasn't concerned about money. He was concerned about you teach in opposition to the local mores and you're going to suffer. Well, I didn't, but the kids did.
But Jane, for five decades, 50 years, you are still in opposition. You've been invited in to a university, to a Fortune 500 company, to a prison, and you are their educator.
I did a program for an elementary school in Washington, D.C. last spring. That neighborhood is suffering through regentrification. So it had been an almost all-black school until now, and now these pale-faced kids are coming in, and they're treating these black kids like the black kids don't belong there. And they're having to do some work with those black kids to make them understand what's happening here, but somebody needs to do a job on those white kids. So I worked with kids in the morning, in the afternoon, then the evening I gave a speech to the school and community. They brought in an older woman, an older black woman, in a wheelchair, and put her at the end of the first row. After I finished speaking, somebody came up and said, so-and-so wants to talk to you. I said, where is she? She said, right down there, and pointed at this black woman. And I went down and I said, what can I do for you? And she started to cry. And she said, I've waited 80 years to hear what you said up there tonight. She's waited 80 years to have somebody say to her, black people started this civilization. Black people populated every landmass on the face of the earth. And if you trace your DNA back far enough, no matter what your skin color is, you will find some DNA that came from a country in Africa. Try it, people. And then don't tell me that there are four or five different races. There's only one. And we are all descendants of those first black people. She had never heard that. She'd waited 80 years to hear that. You know what? That made me sick to my stomach to think what we have done to that fine black woman for 80 years to wait to hear the truth.
Both you and I travel extensively, and you've spoken about host Brown versus Board of Education that said separate is never equal, that schools are more segregated today.
But you see, I don't believe in equality either. You and I will never be equal. I'll never be as young as you are. I'll never be as tall as you are. I will never be your equal. I am not guaranteed equality, but I am guaranteed, or ought to be guaranteed, equitable treatment under the law. I believe in equity. I do not believe in equality.
So talk about equity in school. Do you feel
equity in schools has to mean that everyone will be treated equitably? They will not be forced to be equal. But no matter what your difference is, you still have the right to a good education in a secure environment. And you have the right to respect. And this is something, another change I want to make in the schools. I want people to stop talking about the three R's of reading, writing, and arithmetic. Because only one of those words begins with R. We need to teach rights, respect, and responsibility. Those three words begin with R, and those are the three words that if we would teach those in the schools, if we would educate people to appreciate their rights and to be held responsible for their respect for the rights of others, we could turn this thing around. And then somebody will always say to me, what you want is peace on earth. No, I don't. The grave's a nice and peaceful place, but none, I think, do their embrace. I am not about peace. We will not have peace on this earth until we start treating people equitably. Any yellow or brown or black person who is willing to just wait for peace will die waiting. Martin Luther King Jr. wanted peace, but he knew that he would die working for it. People say to me, when they threaten you with death, are you afraid? No, I'm not afraid. Hopefully I'll go where my son and my husband are. No, I'm not afraid. I think that there's something worse than death, and that is living a useless life. That's worse than death.
I feel like you've been fighting this fabulous battle for 50 years, but you will continue to fight for 50 years. You're so passionate and purposeful. I believe 50 more years are ahead of you.
Don't threaten me with that. I know.
We need you for 50 more years.
No, you don't. What you need is educators who teach children the truth.
You have often said children are not born racist.
Oh, no, no.
They're taught.
There's no gene for racism or sexism or ageism or homophobia or ethnocentrism. Those are all things you have to be carefully taught.
As an educator, your classroom changes daily. It could be on a podcast. It could be at a Fortune 500 company. It could be a university. A student could be an 80-year-old woman in a wheelchair. What is one of the greatest lessons that you teach or educate to these various classrooms that you enter?
They all get the same lesson. There's only one race, and it's really funny when you tell them that. At the University of Houston, 1,500 students and teachers in this room, and I said...
And this is with Angela Davis, I believe.
Angela Davis was on the stage with me, and she came out, and of course they introduced her first, and they should have, and she did her thing, and you know, she has words this long, and the kids are going... And I was too, because I have to separate that word into syllables to understand what it was she said. But she's a fascinating woman. Make no mistake about this. The woman is brilliant and fascinating. And then they said, now, is there something you'd like to say, Ms. Daly? What would you like to say to this group? I said, okay, well, every person in this room who considers himself or herself a member of the white race, please stand. And those white kids jumped up, and they were so proud of themselves. See, when we're first, too. I said, now remain standing. Now will every person in this room who considers himself or herself a member of the black race stand? And they stood. Now the brown race. Now the yellow race. Now the red race, but that doesn't exist because that's just a name. That's a name that we gave that group because we didn't understand that they painted themselves red for special occasions. But we called them red faces anyway. So will those who consider themselves members of that race stand? So they stood. I said, now that everyone's up. Practically everyone is standing. I said, now, will every person in this room who considers himself or herself a member of the human race please sit down? And there was an audible gasp. And they looked at each other and they sat down. And they started to, well, what did she say? And Angela Davis was going. I said, now, since you all are descendants of the same first modern human beings who evolved on this earth, you are all 30th to 50th cousins. So turn to the person on your left, stick out your right hand and say, hello, cousin. And they all did it. It was absolutely magical. And then they started to talk to each other. I said, now turn to the person on your right. Now turn to the person behind you and the person in front of you. Now, you've all found at least four new cousins that you didn't know you had. And you need to know that I get really angry when my pale-faced cousins abuse some of my darker skin cousins because of the pale-faced cousins' ignorance about skin color. You all came from the same modern human beings that they evolved in sub-Saharan Africa 300,000 to 500,000 years ago. And they were like, wow. And I said, now, everybody in this room, take a deep breath. Now, exhale with gusto. Now, take another deep breath. Now, when you exhaled, portions, teeny tiny microcosms of your cells went out into the air around you. That's what happens when you breathe in and out. And when you inhale portions of the people around you. So now, you can never say that you're separate because you just inhaled them. And I said, my husband and I looked alike by the time he died because we had inhaled one another for 60 years. And so, and they were just, and then they started to talk about that. How could that be? Is she right? Oh, I think she's right. It was just, and when we were done, Angela Davis walked up and said, you know, Jane, you and I could go on the road together. I said, well, let me know when you want to go. I think that would be fascinating. She knows more than I will ever learn about racism, but she wouldn't have the right to say what I said or what I did that night because of the ignorance of pale-faced people who think she doesn't have the right to say things that they would disagree with. You see that happen to children. And when we did the exercise and it was filmed by the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, a woman stood up in the audience and said, how could you treat those poor little children that way? I said, if you are upset about what happened to those little white children for one day in the classroom, you must be absolutely infuriated by what happens to children of color in your country and mine on a daily basis. She said, that's different. They're used to it. They can take it. I hear that at least once a month when I'm working. You do not get used to being treated unfairly on the basis of somebody else's ignorance about your skin color. You do not get used to it. What you do is you learn to cope with it. And that's the reason my heroes are black women. They have learned to cope with it, and they go along to get along, and they raise fine children for the most part, every one of them. And they raise children in an atmosphere in which they shouldn't be able to, but you can't put them down. They will not allow you to keep them down. You can say ugly things about them all day long, but they'll go home at night. They'll teach their children to love one another. They'll teach their children that you aren't what they accuse you of. You're okay, you're gonna be okay. They're just ignorant. But how often can you say that to your child and have them believe it, and then they go out the next morning and the whole society says, your mother's wrong. And they keep on doing it. Can you tell me how they can do that?
Let me ask you a question. For over 50 years, you've been challenging people's beliefs and constructs and privilege.
Let's not talk about construct. Let's talk about lies.
Please do.
Yeah, because it's easy to call these things social constructs. This race is a social construct. No, it isn't. It's a goddamn lie. And it should never have been told to anyone. And no one should ever have believed it. And we are still believing it. And we kill people in the name of God because they have a skin that we don't appreciate. Now, that list of white privileges, every one of them says, I can do this and this and this and not be judged unfairly because of my race. I can buy a house that I want to and not be turned down because of my race. Practically every sentence says because of my race. Well, evidently, when she wrote that, she didn't realize there's only one race. Now, if she can do all those things because of her race, then so can every other human being on the face of the earth. She should have said because of the color of my skin. We are educators. They've done studies in this country that prove that the longer you stay in school, the more bigoted you become, because the more convinced you are of what you learned in kindergarten. Every year in school, you are reinforced in what you learned in kindergarten. We celebrate Columbus Day. Columbus didn't discover America. You can't discover a place where people are already living. They discovered it before you got there. People have to realize that Black history did not start with slavery. It started 4,000 years before the birth of Jesus Christ. It's time for us to realize what our history really is. When Barack Obama was elected, I thought, like Whoopi Goldberg said, now I can put my suitcase down. I don't have to plan on leaving anymore. I thought, now we're making progress. Now I can rest and be like everybody else. I can relax. And then the next day, we all found out that the worst thing that ever happened to this country, according to 30% of the people, was a black man was in the White House. And ever since then, the amount of racism in this country has increased.
I love that you would like us to change the way we refer to where the president lives.
That's what it shouldn't be called, the White House. There are lots of White Houses in Washington, D.C., many of them like that house built by black people.
By slaves.
I think we should change the name of that building to the president's residence. I remember when Richard Nixon said to a group of people, I'm trying to save the White House for you white people. I thought, oh, if I were black. But there that president of the United States stood and said, I'm trying to save the White House for you white people. No. That is encouraging ignorance.
When you hear comments like there were very fine people who wore khakis and carried tiki torches at a university in Virginia, I am sure you were apoplectic when you turned on your television and the president was minimizing and marginalizing the effects.
There are good people on both sides. Are you talking about Charlottesville? There are good people on both sides.
I'm talking about Charlottesville.
No, there are not good people on both sides. People who are trying to destroy others because of those people's ignorance about skin color are not good people until some educator takes them by the ear or some other thing that's sticking out and sits them down and says, now here's the way it is, fool. I'm going to teach you how that feels to be treated unfairly on the basis of a physical characteristic over which you have no control. I happen not to like people who have blue eyes. And I'm going to do to you what Hitler did to brown-eyed people during the Holocaust. That's where I learned this exercise. One of the ways they decided who went into the gas chamber during the Holocaust was eye color. If you had a good German name but you had brown eyes, they figured you must be a Jewish person who was trying to pass, and they threw you into the gas chamber or into the work camp or, if you're a child, up in the air and use you for target practice. I get really upset when people make ignorant remarks because of their ignorance about people of different skin colors. Because when some woman says to me, and this happens to me all the time, some liberal, pale-faced woman will say to me, I'll never forget this one, I don't dislike blacks. When I see one, I just think, there but for the grace of God go I. I came unglued. I said, do you think that God woke up one morning and decided to make something beautiful and it made you? She said, that's not what I mean. I said, that's how I perceive it. How dare you say such a thing? She said, I see nothing wrong with it. I said, number one, God is a spirit and has neither gender nor color, but what if God is black? Now, do you want to talk about God anymore? Well, I don't have to listen to this. I said, you're right, you don't. And she stomped away just as fast as she could go on those little high heels. There but for the grace of God go I? No. There but for the fact that those black people moved farther and farther and farther from the equator, and as they moved farther from the equator, their bodies produced less and less melanin. So their skin, their hair, and their eyes got lighter. Their brains didn't get lighter. Their intelligence didn't diminish. So get over it. It has nothing to do with being superior. Skin color is not a determinant of intelligence, nor of worth as a human being.
When you speak so passionately, and I love that you can feel it's visceral. Do you emote visceral responses from your audience?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Some of them want to kill me.
You have no fear, though.
No.
You are fearless.
I was afraid once. I was in Uniontown, Pennsylvania. I spoke to a group of teachers, 400, and I put them through the exercise in a very informal manner. They went ballistic. They were furious. A person from the Pennsylvania Human Relations Commission came to be with me while I was working. In the evening, a black man drove up to the thing, let me out, and he said, now, don't open your door tomorrow morning until you see me. I said, why? He said, I'll pick you up. Do not open this door until you see me through the people. I said, okay. Next morning, the telephone rang. He said, I'm in front of the building. Do not get out. Do not come out the door. I said, okay. He said, you unlock the door and I'll come in. I opened the door. He pushed me out of the way, got in the door, slammed the door, put his back against it and said, now, when you go out of here, you go through that alley and run into the car. And he shoved me out the door. I got into the car. He slammed the door. He got into the back seat with a suitcase on his lap, with it open, slightly open in his hand inside the suitcase. And I thought, these people are paranoid. So after we were done, they took me out to this row houses, pulled up parallel to the sidewalk. They opened the front door. The man got out of the front seat and they said, now, when we say get out, you get out and run up those steps. I said, okay. So they stood beside the door. And as I ran up those steps, there was two black people facing one another on each one of those steps. And I ran through that alley. We got inside and they were all just nervous and talking. They all whispered. I didn't hear anything that was being said. Anna Mae Weems, she said, now we're going to drive to Harrisburg. I said, I thought we were going to Harrisburg tomorrow morning. She said, we're going to Harrisburg tonight. I said, okay. And we headed for Harrisburg. Two carloads of black men behind us, one carload of black men in front of us, all the way to the Pennsylvania Turnpike, going just as fast as we dared. We got to the Pennsylvania Turnpike and I said, look, what's going on here? She said, after you spoke, the superintendent got various calls. And every one of them said, if you don't get that bitch out of town, we're going to shoot her. I said, so that's what this is all about. She said, yes, we don't want you to die in Uniontown, Pennsylvania. I said, well, I can go along with that. So we went to Harrisburg, and I worked all day in Harrisburg, and then Anna Mae Weems went back to her office. The next morning, I woke up in a motel in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. I opened my motel door and looked out, and it was a two-story motel. And for three sides around me and above me, there were windows. And I thought, behind one of those windows could be the person who was sent here to shoot me. And I backed up and I closed the door, and I can remember it as if it had happened yesterday. I told myself, now you've got a choice to make. You can either walk out of here and go home, or you can stay here and be paralyzed and never do this work again. Now what are you gonna do? I had four kids and a husband who loved me at home. I had no choice. So I took that luggage cart handle in my hand. I opened the door, my purse over my shoulder, opened the door, and I walked out and I stiffened my muscles in my back. I guess I thought if they were stiff enough, the bullets would bounce off. You do strange things when you're scared. I was scared, and I walked. I didn't run, because I don't believe you run because you're scared. I believe you're scared because you run. And the minute you start to run, then the adrenaline starts to flow, and then you've got no choice but to keep running. So I walked to the desk, and when I got there, I thought, well, you damn dummy, look what you just did. You allowed them to nearly scare you to death. That will never happen again. They can shoot me. They can run me over. But they cannot scare me to death. And I wasn't scared when the big guy in Omaha was gonna take care of me. And I said, looking at his belly button, because he was so tall and I was not, I said, do you want to have a confrontation here? I mean, he's roaring. I said, do you want a confrontation? Because if you can, we can have one. He finally turns, I don't have to put up with this bullshit. And he tore out of the room. And when the guy hit me at US West, I wasn't scared. I said, I'm gonna get your job. They shipped him out to Wyoming to work. That's worse than firing him. When the guy pulled a knife on me, I said, take your little toad stabber and take it to the back row. I don't want that close to me. I don't want to be close to you. Then take your toad stabber and get out of my way.
What is your hope for the future?
In order to get to the future, you have to get through the future. You can't get through a week without getting through the day. And you can't get through the day without getting through the first few minutes when you wake up. We're in this first few minutes of awakening in this country. Victor Hugo said, no power on earth can stop a man with a dream or an idea whose time has come. Martin Luther King Jr. had a dream. We killed him. Didn't kill the dream. It's more alive now than it ever was because of Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream. Couldn't stop it. No power on earth is going to be able to stop the idea of one race. It's an idea whose time has come. We've got to realize that that's the truth. We've got to teach the truth. We've got to live happily with that truth. Everyone will be more comfortable when white people don't have to live up to an unreal image of what they're able to do, and people of other color groups won't have to live down to white people's expectations of them anymore. I gave a speech someplace in Washington State, I think, and after it was done, this young white male, skinny little guy, I could have taken him out, came bounding down the hall. I was talking to these other people. He said, Elliot, you made me more free than I've ever been in my life. I don't have to put up with this anymore. And he's just delighted because now he doesn't have to say, I can't be with them, they're black. And he doesn't have to say, they won't accept me because I'm white. He can say, we're cousins. And when they leave, oftentimes when they leave, the black kids will say, well, goodbye, Cousin Jane. And I say, goodbye, I'm glad to meet you. Glad to have met you. I hope we meet again. And they come back. And my students come back and say, to this day, they say, what we learned that day is the most important thing I learned in school. If we had educators who refused to perpetuate the myth of white superiority or the presence of more than one race, think of the kind of education you could provide. Nobody ever says to me, when I see you, I don't see you white. Except one time coming out of a school in Berea, Kentucky, maybe. And there was a young black male who had sat through the whole speech and the whole thing. And he said, Miss Elliott, which of your parents is black? I said, well, neither one. Why do you ask? He said, because what you're saying is coming right out of my head, and you couldn't know those things unless you were black. We may be highly trained and highly schooled, but I think you could know those things. I think you could learn those things. And I think this society is going to force you to learn those things.
I'm grateful to our guest, Jane Elliott, for sharing her passionate plea for equity and for her continued fight against bigotry and racism. Jane's exercise allowed her students to see that the color of your skin doesn't make you superior or inferior, and that we are all one race, the human race. To end today's episode, I wanted to highlight Tanya Payne, one of the original freedom writers, and her stories of racism and discrimination in the classroom before entering my class in room 203.
Every school has their kind of gifted track. And from I don't know, second grade, I was in that class atmosphere. So most of the time, I was the only Black student. When I got to Wilson, I had a shell built up and I knew what to expect from my teachers. I was put on a pedestal in a way, and it wasn't a place of honor. I was expected to represent Black people. And my teachers didn't necessarily make that comfortable. Not all of them, for sure. I had fantastic teachers at Wilson, but in particular, my English teacher made things difficult. And by the time I was at the end of my sophomore year, I was fed up and I wrote about it. And so that's what my diary entry focused on, having to be this carrier for the opinions of Black people. That scene in the movie floored me. They used my words, and to see that verbatim, it got me a little bit emotional.
I thought it would be most valuable to begin with Victoria, to give us the Black perspective. Victoria?
Do I have a stamp on my forehead that says the national spokesperson for the plight of Black people? How the hell should I know the Black perspective of the color purple? That's it. If I don't change classes, I'm hurt this fool. Teachers treat me like I'm some kind of Rosetta Stone for African Americans. What? Black people learn how to read and we all miraculously come to the same conclusion?
So inwardly, when my teacher said, you know, hey, Tanya, what's the Black perspective on the color purple? I smiled, and I'm sure there was a little bit of an eye roll and some jaw action on my part, clenching my jaw. But outwardly, I couldn't express how much that comment enraged me, not without risking making all Black people look bad to everyone in that class, or being accused of pulling the race card, or being the one who made it a big deal. And it wasn't a big deal to anyone else, but it was a big deal to me, knowing that what I did in class was not just a reflection of my behavior, but it was a reflection of all Black people. That was the straw that broke the camel's back. I left, and it was probably one of the best decisions I've ever made. My two best friends were actually students in Aaron's class. What they got was a teacher who didn't care that they were, I guess, an exception to the norm. So I went to Miss G and I asked her if I could be in her class. And I explained where I was coming from and who I was, and she agreed. So my junior year, I left the Distinguished Scholars Program, much to my teacher's dismay. They told me that I would not get into the colleges that I wanted, that her class would be too easy and not a challenge, and that if I wanted to excel academically and get into the classes that I wanted, that I needed to stay in their classes. But I left. Going from the Distinguished Scholars Program at Wilson and being put in Aaron's classroom, I went in with this expectation that I was already light years ahead of them. And it was humbling to realize that I was not. And I learned so much from not even just Aaron, but my classmates. And one of the things that I'm most grateful for was developing the confidence to be myself for the first time, I think, in my academic career. And that came about through my relationship with the Freedom Riders. It pushed me in ways that I was not anticipating. I've got a lot more confidence in who I am now and what I bring to the world because I'm a Freedom Rider. Somewhere right now, there are hundreds of thousands of students who are being pigeonholed by their teachers. I hope that the movie gives them hope, but also I hope that it gives them power to not accept the limitations that others put on them. I hope that they take courage and heart and that they stand up for themselves, because there's power and there's joy in standing up for yourself, even in the face of so much opposition.
Thank you, Tanya, for your powerful story. As we end the show this week, I hope we can take the lessons that both of our guests shared to heart. May we work to end discrimination and hate. May we seek to use education to lead people out of ignorance. And in honor of Jane's hero, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., may we all dream of a day where we are not judged by the color of our skin, but by the content of our character. That concludes our show this week. Thank you so much for listening. Once again, I'm your host, Erin Grubo. This episode was produced and edited by Matt Martin Hall and Rob Falk. Until next time, dear listeners, may you write what needs to be written and tell what needs to be told.